Part 2. The Creepy Corpus. This is an article from the newspaper that Stephen King used to write for in college called The Main Campus. The headline reads, Ex-campus writer hits the big time. Story as follows. A former columnist for The Main Campus and a UMO graduate made his debut on the big money literary scene, the campus learned last week. Stephen E. King, author of a popular campus column of the late 60s, King's Garbage Truck, learned last March that Doubleday & Company, Incorporated, purchased the hardcover rights to his novel, Carrie, for $2,500 plus royalties on sales. Doubleday expects to publish the hardcover version of the novel, which tells the story of a high school girl with telekinetic powers, ability to spiritually cause objects to move, next January. King jumped into the big money bracket last week, however, when he learned from Doubleday that New American Library purchased the paperback rights to Carrie for a reported $4 million. King has been guaranteed 50% of that figure, plus royalties on sales. The paperback edition is expected to be published sometime early in 1975. Currently an English instructor at Hampton Academy, King is a 1970 graduate of UMO, holding a B.S. in education. Prior to the sale of Carrie, he published several short stories in Cavalier and Atom magazines. It's probably wrong to believe there can be any limit to the horror which the human mind can experience, and the most terrifying question of all may be just how much horror the human mind can stand and still maintain a wakeful, staring, unrelenting sanity. Pet Sematary. 1. The Novels. Stephen King is a very prolific novelist. He doesn't just get a bookshelf in fans' homes, he gets an entire bookcase, or three. Stephen King shelfies are especially popular on Stephen King Facebook groups. Carrie, 1974. Quote, Carrie White may be picked on by her classmates, but she has a gift. Carrie was originally a short story that King threw away. It was rescued from the trash by his wife, Tabitha. I did three single-spaced pages of a first draft, then crumpled them up in disgust and threw them away, King wrote in On Writing. In On Becoming a Brand Name, King wrote, The story had so many strikes against it from the very beginning that it never should have been written at all. The first problem had occurred about an hour after I sat down and began writing. I decided I couldn't write it at all. I was in a totally foreign environment, a girl's shower room, and writing about teenage girls. I felt completely at sea. Continuing a fun tradition in his writing, Stephen King himself makes two cameo appearances in Carrie, his first published novel. Well, two personas of Stephen King. One of Carrie's teachers was Edwin King, and Stephen King's middle name is Edwin. And the folk singer who performed at the UN High School prom, the Black Prom, was John Swithin. John Swithin was the pseudonym Stephen King used in 1972 to publish, in Cavalier magazine, his crime short story, The Fifth Quarter. The 1976 film adaptation of Carrie, starring Sissy Spacek, Piper Laurie, Amy Irving, William Catt, Nancy Allen, and John Travolta, is one of the most beloved film versions of any Stephen King stories. In 1988, Carrie, the musical, starring Betty Buckley and Lindsay Hatley, opened on Broadway. It was directed by Terry Hands, and the book was by Lawrence D. Cohen, who had written the screenplay to the Brian De Palma screen adaptation of the novel. He also wrote the original It miniseries. Music was by Michael Gore with lyrics by Dean Pitchford. It closed after five performances, but was revived off-Broadway in 2012, where it was much more warmly received. Since then, it has been staged in Seattle and Manila in 2013, and Los Angeles and London in 2015. Essential Stephen King Ranking 20. Salem's Lot, 1975. Ben Mears has returned to Jerusalem's Lot. This is King's classic vampire novel, essentially a modern-day Dracula. King's original title for Salem's Lot was Second Coming. King's childhood friend, Chris Chesley, tells the story of having dinner with King and Tabitha and discussing Bram Stoker's Dracula. They mused about whether or not it was possible for Dracula to exist in modern times, i.e., Dracula in the frozen food section of the grocery store. This inspired King to take a swing at writing a novel in which a vampire exists in contemporary America. In On Becoming a Brand Name, King recalls the dinner. The dinner conversation that night was a speculation on what might happen if Dracula returned today, not to London with its teeming millions, as Stoker puts it with such purely Victorian complacency, but to rural America. I began to turn the idea over in my mind, and it began to coalesce into a possible novel. I thought it would make a good one, if I could create a fictional town with enough prosaic reality about it to offset the comic book menace of a bunch of vampires. King told the same story during his lecture at the Billerica Library, which is reprinted in Secret Windows. With Salem's Lot, I was teaching Dracula in high school. We were talking about it with a friend one night at supper, and I said, This is the magic question. What would happen if Dracula came back today? And my wife said, Well, he'd land at Port Authority in New York and get run over by a taxi cab, and that'd be the end of him. And then this friend of mine said, But suppose he came back to a little town somewhere inland in Maine. You know, you go through some of those little towns and everybody could be dead and you'd never know it. King once gave serious thought to writing a sequel to Salem's Lot. In a 1982 interview with Fangoria magazine, King actually revealed how such a sequel would begin. "I think about a sequel a lot. I even know who could be in it and how it could launch. It's Father Callahan. I know where he is. He went to New York City, and from New York he drifted across the country and he landed in Detroit. He's in the inner city, and he's running a soup kitchen for alcoholics, and he's been attacked a couple of times, and people think he's crazy. He doesn't wear the turned-around collar anymore, but he's trying to get right with God. So one day this guy comes in. He's dying and says, 'I have to talk to you, Father Callahan.' And Callahan says, 'I'm not a father anymore, and how did you know that?' As the guy dies, the last thing he says as he grabs Callahan by the shirt and pulls him down into this mist of beer and whiskey and puke is, 'It's not over in the lot yet.' Then he drops dead." In On Writing, King describes Salem Lot as a peculiar combination of Peyton Place and Dracula. Essential Stephen King ranking, 8. Rage, written as Richard Bachman, 1977. Dear readers, please note that this particular synopsis contains spoilers. Considering the limited availability of the novel, it is included here for King fans who may never get their hands on a copy. If you have not read Rage, and you do foresee the day when you will find and read a copy, then eschew the reading of this synopsis. Wikipedia synopsis of Rage. Charlie Decker, a Maine high school senior, is called to a meeting with his principal about a previous incident in which he struck his chemistry teacher with a pipe wrench, leading to the teacher's hospitalization and Charlie's suspension. For unknown reasons, Charlie subjects the principal to a series of insulting remarks, resulting in his expulsion. Charlie storms out of the office and retrieves a pistol from his locker, then sets the contents of his locker on fire. He then returns to his classroom and fatally shoots his algebra teacher. The fire triggers an alarm, but Charlie forces his classmates to stay in the room, killing another teacher when he attempts to enter. As the other students and teachers evacuate the school, the police and media arrive on the scene. Over the following 4 hours, Charlie toys with various authority figures who attempt to negotiate with him, including the principal, the school psychologist, and the local police chief. Charlie gives them certain commands, threatening to kill students if they do not comply. Charlie also admits to his hostages that he does not know what has compelled him to commit his deeds, believing he will regret them when the situation is over. As his fellow students start identifying with Charlie, he unwittingly turns his class into a sort of psychotherapy group, causing his schoolmates to semi-voluntarily tell embarrassing secrets regarding themselves and each other. Interspersed throughout are narrative flashbacks to Charlie's troubled childhood, particularly his tumultuous relationship with his abusive father. Several notable incidents include a violent disagreement between two female students and a police sniper's attempt to shoot Charlie through the heart. However, Charlie survives due to the bullet striking his locker's combination lock, which he had earlier placed in the breast pocket of his shirt. Charlie finally comes to the realization that only one student is really being held against his will, a seeming big man on campus named Ted Jones, who is harboring his own secrets. Ted realizes this and attempts to escape the classroom, but the other students brutally assault him, driving him into a battered catatonic state. At 1 p.m., Charlie releases the students, but Ted is unable to move under his own power and remains. When the police chief enters the classroom, the now unarmed Charlie moves as if to shoot him, attempting suicide by cop. The chief shoots Charlie, but he survives and is found not guilty by reason of insanity and committed to a psychiatric hospital in Augusta, Maine, until he can answer for his actions. The final chapters contain an interoffice memo concerning Ted's treatment and prognosis at the hospital where he is now a patient, and a letter from one of Charlie's friends describing assorted developments in the students' lives during the months following this incident. The story ends with Charlie addressing the reader. "That's the end. I have to turn off the light now. Good night." King's original title for Rage, his first Richard Bachman novel, was Getting It On. Rage is about a high school hostage situation and shooting. After a series of school shootings in the 1980s and 1990s, King decided he wasn't comfortable with the book remaining in print. Rage is still available in older editions as used books, but it is officially out of print with the publisher. King cited the December 1997 shooting by Michael Carneal, 14, in Kentucky, as the tipping point for his decision to pull the book from print. Carneal killed 3 and wounded 5 people of a prayer group with a Ruger MK2 semi-automatic pistol, and it was later discovered that he had a copy of the Bachman Omnibus, which has Rage in it, in his locker. In his keynote address at the Vermont Library Conference's annual meeting on May 26, 1999, King said, "The Carneal incident was enough for me. I asked my publisher to take the damn thing out of print. They concurred." King also addressed Rage in his 2013 essay, Guns. "I didn't pull Rage from publication because the law demanded it. I was protected under the First Amendment, and the law couldn't demand it. I pulled it because in my judgment it might be hurting people, and that made it the responsible thing to do. Assault weapons will remain readily available to crazy people until the powerful pro-gun forces in this country decide to do a similar turnaround. They must accept responsibility. Recognizing that responsibility is not the same as culpability. They need to say, we support these measures not because the law demands we support them, but because it's the sensible thing. In a BBC documentary on Stephen King that aired in the United States on December 19, 1999, on the Learning Channel, King said, I've written a lot of books about teenagers who are pushed to violent acts, but with Rage, it's almost a blueprint in terms of saying, this is how it could be done. And when it started to happen, particularly, there was a shooting thing in Paducah, Kentucky, where three kids were killed in a prayer group, and the kid who did it, that book was in his locker. And I said, that's it for me. That book's off the market. Not that they won't find something else. I don't think that any kid was driven to an act of violence by a Metallica record or by a Marilyn Manson CD or by a Stephen King novel. But I do think those things can act as accelerants. The Cherokee nose job, vividly described by Charlie in the novel, actually was used by the Plains Indians, including the Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws, Creeks, and Seminoles. In Chapter 13 of his book, Commerce of the Prairies, Josiah Gregg writes, adultery is punished by cutting off both the nose and ears of the adulteress, but the husband has the right to say if the law shall be executed. In fact, he is generally the executioner, and that often without trial. A stage adaptation of Rage, written by Robert B. Parker and starring Parker's son Daniel as Charlie Decker, debuted at the Blackburn Theater in Gloucester, Massachusetts on March 30, 1989. Essential Stephen King ranking, 31. The Shining, 1977. Quote, Jack Torrance's new job at the Overlook Hotel is the perfect chance for a fresh start. End quote. The Shining is one of King's most loved, acclaimed, and literary novels. He was 29 when he wrote it. In a March 1979 interview with Mel Allen in Yankee Magazine, King talked about writing the novel's bathtub scene. When I was writing The Shining, there was a scene I was terrified of having to face writing. Writing is a pretty intense act of visualization. I won't say it's magic, but it's pretty close to magic. There was this woman in the tub, dead and bloated for years, and she gets up and starts to come for the boy who can't get the door open. The closer I got to having to write it, the more I worried about it. I didn't want to have to face that unspeakable thing in the tub any more than the boy did. Two or three nights running, before I got to that section, I dreamed there was a nuclear explosion on the lake where we lived. The mushroom cloud turned into a huge red bird that was coming for me, but when I finished with the scene, it was gone. In the mid-1970s, King and his wife Tabitha checked into the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, exactly when the hotel was preparing to close for the season. King and his wife ended up essentially alone in the hotel, along with a skeleton crew. Sorry. And since King's mind works the way it does, the story of the Torrances came to him, and he decided to write it down. Many of the elements of the novel, the fire hose, the long corridors, the ballroom, are derived from King's stay at the Stanley. King's use of red rum as a totemic portent sent to Danny by his alter ego Tony is very clever and has become an oft-cited part of the culture. The Shining was Stephen King's first bestseller. The Shining is about as literarily significant as it gets. It is one of those rare books about which a book, The Shining Reader, by Dr. Tony Magistrale, has been written. The undeniable gravitas of the novel has also spawned some fairly serious literary critique, including such essays as The Red Rum of Time, A Meditation of Francisco Goya's Saturn Devouring His Children and Stephen King's The Shining, by Greg Weller, and The Red Death's Sway, Setting and Character in Poe's The Mask of the Red Death and King's The Shining, by Leonard Mustaza. Stanley Kubrick's film adaptation of the novel is one of the most loved, hated, controversial, and microanalyzed cinematic version of a King work ever created. In the novel, Jack dies a martyr, sacrificing himself and the Overlook Hotel for his family. In the film, he dies a raging psychopath intent on murdering his family. Kubrick completely reversed Jack's motivation and conclusion, and only reluctantly, when Grady lets Jack out of the cupboard, acknowledged the supernatural component of the hotel's influence on Jack. Essential Stephen King ranking, 3. The Long Walk, written as Richard Bachman, 1978. Quote, against the wishes of his mother, 16-year-old Ray Garrity is about to compete in The Long Walk. End quote. The Long Walk is one of King's most psychologically dense novels, and it is one of his tales which most compellingly communicates the individual terrors, insecurities, and weaknesses of its characters. The Long Walk contains many clues that it was actually written by Stephen King instead of Richard Bachman. These include references to Pownall and Bangor, Maine, mention in the text of a gunslinger, dedications to longtime King associates Bert Hatlin, Jim Bishop, and Ted Holmes, and a mention of King favorites Edgar Allan Poe and Ray Bradbury. Additionally, there is a foreshadowing of the playing elevator scene in The Shining when Ray Garrity remembers his father picking him up and swinging him wildly, and even an RF character, Roger Fenham, who was the 50th boy to go down. Jay Holbin, see his essay in this volume, the director of Paranoid, the 2000 short film adaptation of King's chilling poem, Paranoid, A Chant, concluded his film with the following on-screen quotation, "And when the hand touched his shoulder again, he somehow found the strength to run." That quote is the final line of The Long Walk. Runners and walkers consider a 4 miles per hour pace to be very brisk. Essential King ranking, 28. The Stand, 1978. Quote, "A patient escapes from a biological testing facility, unknowingly carrying a deadly weapon, a mutated strain of superflu that will wipe out 99% of the world's population within a few weeks." End quote. The Stand has consistently been the fans' favorite Stephen King novel. When I wrote The Essential Stephen King, I ranked it as King's greatest work and put The Stand at number 2. I stand by my decision, but I quickly learned that The Stand is the fans' most beloved King novel. Some readers suggested my first and second ranking should be reversed, but I still think King's magnum opus is it. And I say that knowing full well that, in the classic sense of the definition of magnum opus, it would probably be the Dark Tower series, but I went with single volumes for my ranking. When Stephen King completed writing The Stand in 1977, he did not have the marketability he does now. Today, King can publish 2 hardcovers at once, Desperation and The Regulators, 6 individual novellas in a row, The Green Mile, a novel and novella available only on the internet, Riding the Bullet and The Plant, and everything sells. Everything sells. Publishers don't balk anymore or fear Stephen King overexposure. Back in 1977, it was a different story. King was required to cut almost 150,000 words from the manuscript of The Stand, bringing it down to around 400,000 words, before Doubleday would publish it. King reissued the novel with the cut material restored, plus some minor editorial changes in 1990 as The Stand, the complete and uncut edition. See my complete Stephen King encyclopedia for details on the restored characters and scenes. In a March 1979 interview with Mel Allen in Yankee Magazine, King talked about the genesis and writing of The Stand. "I wrote, a dark man with no face, and then glanced up and saw that grisly little motto again. Once in every generation, a plague will fall among them. And that was that. I spent the next 2 years writing an apparently endless book called The Stand. It got to the point where I began describing it to friends as my own little Vietnam, because I kept telling myself that in another 100 pages or so, I would begin to see the light at the end of the tunnel." King has always been intrigued by the question of the existence or presence of an empirical evil in the affairs of mankind, and Randall Flagg, and many of his RF characters throughout King's entire canon, is the manifestation of this primal evil reality. In The Stand, we first meet Mr. Flagg and learn that not only is he Legion, but that he is indestructible, as the coda to the uncut edition of The Stand unequivocally tells us. In his 2016 essay, 5-1, 1-5, in Hearts in Suspension, King writes that his poem, Harrison State Park, 68, was a precursor to The Stand. Essential Stephen King ranking, 2. The Dead Zone, 1979. Quote, "When Johnny Smith was 6 years old, head trauma caused by a bad ice skating accident left him with hunches." End quote. The Dead Zone is a political/paranormal thriller. Many readers believe that Stephen King predicted the persona and presidency of Donald Trump with the character of Greg Stilson in this novel. King has been extremely vocal and negative about Trump, mainly via Twitter, to the point that Trump blocked King after some of his tweets. In an April 1, 2017 essay for the UK Guardian, Stephen King on Donald Trump, "How Do Such Men Rise? First as a Joke," he talked about the comparison between Greg Stilson and Donald Trump. "I had written about such men before. In The Dead Zone, Greg Stilson is a door-to-door Bible salesman with a gift of gab, a ready wit, and the common touch. He is laughed at when he runs for mayor in his small New England town, but he wins. He is laughed at when he runs for the House of Representatives. Part of his platform is a promise to rocket America's trash into outer space. But he wins again. When Johnny Smith, the novel's precognitive hero, shakes his hand, he realizes that someday Stilson is going to laugh and joke his way into the White House, where he will start World War III. During the period when Johnny was in his coma, Sarah Bracknell lived in Vesey, Maine on Flagg Street. In a July 1984 interview with David Sherman in Fangoria magazine, King talked about The Dead Zone. "What always happens for me with a book is that you frame the idea of the book or the what if, and little by little, characters will take shape. Generally, as a result of a secondary decision about the plot, in the case of The Dead Zone, it was simply, what if a man was able to have this ability to see the future? What if you were to explore that idea in the book, if he was just an ordinary guy that could really do it? The secondary thing was the visualization of this guy taking a test paper from a student and saying, "You gotta go home right away. Your house is burning down." That never actually appears in the book, but it set the thing of him as a teacher. There were some other decisions that were made, and then it was time to pick the book up and begin to go. Essential Stephen King ranking, 4. Firestarter, 1980. Quote, Andy McGee and Vicki Tomlinson were once college students, volunteering as test subjects for an experiment orchestrated by the clandestine government organization known as The Shop. End quote. The main character in Firestarter, Charlie McGee, can start fires with her mind. When Charlie's mother was pregnant with her, her parents participated in government experiments that resulted in her having pyrotechnic abilities. Firestarter is Stephen King at his most paranoid, and the novel can be thematically linked with King's 1985 poem, Paranoid, A Chant, in which a narrator believes he is being surveilled for some horrible, nefarious reason. In Firestarter, one of the shop's clinical psychologist psychotherapists is named Dr. Patrick Hochstetter. In King's 1986 novel, It, we are told that a Derry resident named Patrick Hochstetter disappeared in 1958. Eddie Kasprak does dream that he sees Hochstetter's decomposing body, but it is only a dream, and by novel's end, Hochstetter is still missing. Is it possible that these two Patrick Hochstetters are the same character? If this theory is correct, Patrick Hochstetter vanished from Derry in 1958 when he was approximately 11 years old and surfaced 20 or so years later as a shop doctor, and King used it to reveal Hochstetter's backstory, powerfully linking the two tales. Some readers believe the two characters' names are merely a coincidence. My thinking is that Patrick Hochstetter is a pretty specific name to coincidentally use twice. In an interview with Douglas E. Winter in Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, King talked about what he considered the most horrifying scene in the book. To me, the most horrifying scene in the book is the outright terrorism that goes on in a lunchroom when the shop is looking for Andy and Charlie. This shop agent terrorizes first a waitress and then a short-order cook. It's an awful piece of work. To suggest that there aren't guys like that who are actually getting their salaries from the taxpayers is to claim that there aren't guys like Gordon Liddy who ever worked for the CIA. And they love their work, man. They love their fucking work. A film adaptation of Firestarter came out in 1984 starring David Keith, Drew Barrymore, Heather Locklear, and Martin Sheen. It was directed by Mark L. Lester from a screenplay by Stanley Mann. A new film adaptation of Firestarter was announced in April 2017 to be directed by Akiva Goldsman. Essential Stephen King ranking, 19. Roadwork, initially as Richard Bachman, 1980. Quote, "It's all coming to an end for Barton Dawes." End quote. Roadwork was written a year after King's mother had died of cancer, and initially, he considered it the worst of his Bachman books because it was trying to find some answers to the conundrum of human pain. King later reassessed the book and said he considered it his favorite of the early Bachman books. Barton Dawes remembers shooting a jay with a new rifle when he was 12 and not killing it. When he approached it, he saw the beak opening and closing. In desperation, Audrey tells the same story of shooting a jay when she was 12, not killing it, and the beak slowly opening and closing. The question posed in Roadwork is, how much can one person take before snapping? Dawes lost his young son to cancer, his wife to divorce, and the city, for no good reason, has plans to take his house and the laundry where he works for an unnecessary highway extension. Like most Bachman books, Roadwork does not have a happy ending. As of this writing, there have been no film adaptations of Roadwork, either as a feature film or as a dollar baby. Cujo, 1981. Quote, Cujo used to be a big friendly dog, lovable and loyal to his trinity, the man, the woman, and the boy, and always did his best to not be a bad dog. End quote. It is impossible to know how many Cujo jokes have been made in TV shows and movies since this book and movie came out. Is there a dog in the scene? In many cases, it will be referred to as Cujo at some point. It always gets a laugh, and it's always a cheap laugh. It's too easy. In On Writing, King wrote of Cujo, "At the end of my adventures, I was drinking a case of 16-ounce tall boys a night, and there's one novel, Cujo, that I barely remember writing at all. I don't say that with pride or shame, only with a vague sense of sorrow and loss. I like that book. I wish I could remember enjoying the good parts as I put them down on the page." At one point in Cujo, Donna Trenton recalls that Cujo was the name of one of the members of the radical terrorist group the Symbionese Liberation Army, the organization that kidnapped Patty Hearst. King has, from time to time, talked about a novel he began writing in 1974 called The House on Value Street, which was about the SLA's kidnapping of Patty Hearst. That novel metamorphosed into The Stand. In a 1982 interview with Douglas E. Winter in Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, King talked about an incident that planted the seeds of Cujo. "I took the bike out there, and I just barely made it, and this huge St. Bernard came out of the barn growling. Then this guy came out, and, I mean, he was Joe Camber. He looked like one of those guys out of Deliverance. And I was retreating and wishing that I was not on my motorcycle when the guy said, "Don't worry, he don't bite." And so I reached out to pet him, and the dog started to go for me. And the guy walked over and said, "Down, Gonzo," or whatever the dog's name was, and gave him this huge whack on the rump, and the dog yelped and sat down. The guy said, "Gonzo's never done that before. I guess he don't like your face." A film version of Cujo came out in 1983 starring Dee Wallace, Danny Pintaro, Daniel Hugh Kelly, Christopher Stone, and Ed Lauder. It was directed by Lewis Teague from a screenplay by Don Carlos Dunaway and Lauren Currier. Essential Stephen King ranking, 16. The Running Man, initially as Richard Bachman, 1981. Quote, "Ben Richards is a desperate man," end quote. Stephen King wrote this novel in a weekend. It can take some fans more time than that to read it. Ben Richards has to survive 30 days without being captured to win $1 million. If he's caught, he'll be killed. And he can kill anyone trying to capture him. King likes this Bachman novel. In Why I Was Bachman, the introduction to the October 1985 New American Library omnibus edition of The Bachman Books, he said, "The Running Man may be the best of them all because it's nothing but story. It moves with a goofy speed of a silent movie, and anything which is not story is cheerfully thrown over the side." In a spooky precognitive finale, spoiler alert, Ben Richards hijacks a plane and flies it into the tallest building in New York. Heeling over slightly, the Lockheed struck the Games building dead on, three-quarters of the way up. Its tanks were still better than a quarter full. Its speed was slightly over 500 miles an hour. The explosion was tremendous, lighting up the night like the wrath of God, and it rained fire 20 blocks away. King mentions both Harding and Derry in The Running Man. Harding is the setting for King's unpublished Race Riot novel, Sword in the Darkness. Derry is the setting for It, Insomnia, Dreamcatcher, and other King works. Like the rest of the Bachman tales, The Running Man paints a bleak picture of our future and ends on a defiantly pessimistic note. This dark sensibility is why Ace Books initially rejected the novel, telling King they were not interested in science fiction that dealt with negative utopias. In August 2000, a Berlin-based company inaugurated a game called Reality Run, which the creators acknowledged was based on Stephen King's novel, The Running Man. The main difference, of course, was that the contestant only lost the game, not his life, if he was not able to remain on the run for 24 days. The first contestant was captured in 7 days by a German woman. She won the $10,000 grand prize that the contestant would have garnered had he been able to elude recognition and identification for the entire 24 days. The other difference between the book and the game is that viewers monitored the runner on realityrun.com instead of on television. A film version of The Running Man came out in 1987 starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Conchita Alonso. It was directed by Paul Michael Glazer from a screenplay by Stephen E. D'Souza. The movie is a lame and unfaithful adaptation, but still notable for its interesting casting, including former pro wrestler Jesse Ventura, Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac, Frank Zappa's son Dweezil, and Family Feud host Richard Dawson. Considering the talent involved, this film should have been better than it is. King spoke about this film in the January 2001 issue of the magazine Writer's Journal. "I didn't care for the way they made The Running Man very much. It was not very much like my book, and I liked that book a lot. I related to a period of my life that I enjoyed, and I remember the writing of it with great affection. I didn't like the movie, but I kept my mouth shut. Now the movie's gone, but the book rules." Essential Stephen King ranking, 41. The Dark Tower synopsis. A note about the Dark Tower series. As a gesture of literary respect, as well as a nod to the vagaries of word count and the number of pages in this book, we decided not to attempt to reduce this masterpiece to bullet points. However, to provide some spoiler-free details about the books and to acclimate new readers to the complete story, below are the official synopsis of each book from www.stephenking.com. The Dark Tower 1, The Gunslinger, 1982. The first book of King's Dark Tower series. The man in black fled across the desert, and the gunslinger followed. So begins book 1 of Stephen King's iconic fantasy series, The Dark Tower. Part sci-fi novel, part futuristic dystopia, part spaghetti western, and part high fantasy vision, The Gunslinger tells the story of Roland Deschain, Midworld's last gunslinger, who is tracking an enigmatic magician known only as the Man in Black. Following his quarry across the demon-infested Mohane Desert, Roland confronts a mad preacher woman and her murderous flock, holds palaver with a speaking demon, and finally befriends a young boy from our world named Jake Chambers. Jake joins Roland on his quest, but while Roland travels with his young companion Jake, the man in black travels with Roland's soul in his pocket. The Gunslinger begins with a line that fits Stephen King's own description of an opener that works, a great hooker. The man in black fled across the desert and the gunslinger followed. See King's nonfiction essay, Great Hookers I Have Known, in his collection Secret Windows for more on what makes a killer opening sentence. Essential Stephen King ranking, 10. 10, whole series. The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, Revised, 2003. This is a rewritten version of the original novel, which was a collection of short stories and not really a novel. This version provides more narrative cohesion. The original version is officially out of print, but available from used booksellers. The Dark Tower 2, The Drawing of the Three, 1987. The second volume of King's Dark Tower series. After his final confrontation with the man in black in a remote mountain Golgotha, an exhausted Roland awakes on the beach of the Western Sea and is immediately attacked by a shoreline monster known as a Lobstrosity. Roland kills the clawed creature, but not before it bites off two of his fingers and half of one big toe. Fighting off the delirium brought on by the Lobstrosity's poison, Roland forces himself along the beach where he discovers three freestanding doorways that lead into our world. The first opens onto New York, 1987, and the mind of a heroin addict called Eddie Dean. The second leads to 1964 and the divided personality of Odetta Holmes / Detta Walker, an African-American woman who has lost the bottom half of her legs but gained a second psychotic self. The third door leads to 1977 and the mind of a psychopath called The Pusher, the very criminal responsible for Odetta's injuries. Roland's task is to make Eddie and Odetta into gunslingers before raging Detta destroys them all, and before The Pusher can continue his bloody killing spree. The Dark Tower 3, The Wastelands, 1991, the third volume of King's Dark Tower series. Several months have passed, and Roland's two new tetmates have become proficient gunslingers. Eddie Dean has given up heroin, and Odetta's two selves have joined, becoming the stronger and more balanced personality of Susanna Dean. But while battling The Pusher in 1977 New York, Roland altered Ka by saving the life of Jake Chambers, a boy who, in Roland's Where and When, has already died. Now Roland and Jake exist in different worlds, but they are joined by the same madness, the paradox of double memories. Roland, Susanna, and Eddie must draw Jake into Midworld, then follow the path of the beam all the way to the Dark Tower. But nothing is easy in Midworld. Along the way, our Tet stumbles into the ruined city of Ludd and are caught between the warring gangs of the Pubes and the Greys. The only way out of Ludd is to wake Blaine the Mono, an insane train that has a passion for riddling and for suicidal journeys. The Dark Tower 4, Wizard and Glass, 1997, the fourth volume of King's Dark Tower series. Roland, Eddie, Susanna, Jake, and Jake's pet Bumbler survive Blaine the Mono's final crash, only to find themselves stranded in an alternate version of Topeka, Kansas, one that has been ravaged by the superflu virus. While following the deserted I-70 toward a distant glass palace, they hear the atonal squalling of a thinny, a place where the fabric of existence has almost entirely worn away. While camping near the edge of the thinny, Roland tells his quartet story about another thinny, one that he encountered when he was little more than a boy. Over the course of one long magical night, Roland transports us to the Midworld of long ago and a seaside town called Hambry, where Roland fell in love with a girl named Susan Delgado, and where he and his old tetmates, Elaine and Cuthbert, battled the forces of John Farson, the Harrier who, with a little help from a seeing sphere called Marilyn's Grapefruit, ignited Midworld's final war. The Dark Tower 5, Wolves of the Kala, 2003, the fifth volume of King's Dark Tower series. Roland and his Tet have just returned to the path of the beam when they discover that they are being followed by a group of inexperienced trackers. The trackers are from the town of Calabrin Sturgis, and they desperately need the help of gunslingers. Once every generation, a band of masked riders known as the Wolves gallop out of the dark land of Thunderclap to steal one half of all the twins born in the Kalas. When the children are returned, they are ruined, or mentally and physically ruined. In less than a month, the Wolves will raid again. In exchange for Roland's aid, Father Callahan, a priest originally from our world, offers to give Roland a powerful but evil seeing sphere, a sinister globe called Black 13, which he has hidden below the floorboards of his church. Not only must Roland and his Tet discover a way to defeat the invincible Wolves, but they must also return to New York so that they can save our world's incarnation of the Dark Tower from the machinations of the evil Sombra Corporation. The Dark Tower 6, Song of Susanna, 2004. The sixth volume of King's Dark Tower series. The Wolves have been defeated, but our Tet faces yet another catastrophe. Susanna Dean's body has been usurped by a demon named Mia, who wants to use Susanna's mortal form to bear a demon child. Stealing Black 13, Mia has traveled through the unfound door to 1999 New York, where she plans to give birth to her chap, a child born of two mothers and two fathers, who will grow up to be Roland's nemesis. With the help of the time-traveling Manny, Roland and Eddie plan to follow Susanna while Father Callahan and Jake will find Calvin Tower, owner of the vacant lot where a magical rose grows, a rose that must be saved at all costs. But despite our quartet's intentions, Ka has its own plans. Jake, Callahan and Jake's bumbler companion are transported to New York to follow Susanna, while Eddie and Roland are tumbled into East Stoneham, Maine, where they are greeted by Eddie's old enemy, the gangster Balazar. But it isn't just bullets that Roland and Eddie must brave. Soon, they will meet their maker in the form of a young author named Stephen King. The Dark Tower 7, The Dark Tower, 2004, the final volume of King's Dark Tower series. At the outset of the final installment of our saga, Roland's quartet is scattered across several different wheres and whens. Susanna Dean, still in the clutches of the demon Mia, is in Endworld's Fetic Dogen, a chamber of horrors where magic and technology can be merged and where a monstrous half-human child can be brought forth into the world. Eddie Dean and Roland Deschain are in Maine, 1977, searching for the site of otherworldly walk-in activity and a possible doorway back to Midworld. Jake Chambers, Father Callahan, and the bumbler Oi are battling vampires and lowmen in New York's Dixie Pig restaurant circa 1999, a place where Long Pig is definitely on the menu. As soon as our tet reunites, they must journey to the headquarters of Thunderclap's Wolves in order to discover exactly why the Crimson King's minions have been culling the brains of young children for twin telepathy enzymes. The answer is more horrible than they realized, and bears directly upon Roland's quest to reach the Dark Tower. The Dark Tower, The Wind Through the Keyhole, 2012. Although it is officially the eighth book of the Dark Tower saga, Stephen King likes to call The Wind Through the Keyhole book 4.5 of the series, since it takes place after our Ted escapes the Green Palace at the end of Wizard and Glass and before they reach Kala Bryn Sturgis, setting for the Wolves of Kala. The Wind Through the Keyhole is a story within a story within a story. At the outset, Roland and his American Ted are traveling toward the River Wye in Midworld. A great storm called a Stark Blast is about to blow. While our Tet is sheltering from the storm, Roland tells a story about his younger days, when he and his Tet mate Jamie DeCurry were sent to DeBaria to investigate reports of a skin man, a kind of dangerous shape-changer. While trying to comfort a young boy named Bill Streeter, the only survivor of a particularly brutal attack by the skin man and Roland's only witness to the crime, Roland recounts yet another story. This time, it is a sinister fairy tale drawn from the book Magic Tales of Eld. The three stories are woven together by the freezing, howling winds of the Stark Blast. The Little Sisters of Illyria. This Dark Tower spin-off story first appeared in the 1998 anthology Legends. The Little Sisters of Illyria is a prequel to the first volume of the Dark Tower saga. Roland's beloved city of Gilead has fallen to the good man's forces, and the gunslingers have been slaughtered at the Battle of Jericho Hill. Roland is now a lone wanderer, searching for the trail of the elusive sorcerer known as the Man in Black. On a hot day during the season of full earth, Roland enters a deserted town in the Desatoya Mountains. The town is called Illyria, and it is empty except for a lame dog, a drowned boy, and the eerie sound of tinkling silver bells. As Roland searches for the town's missing inhabitants, he is attacked by the slow mutants known as the Green Folk. Our unconscious hero is rescued by an itinerant band of female healers who call themselves the Little Sisters of Illyria. But Roland's rescuers are not what they seem, and our gunslinger must fight their narcotic potions to stay awake and alive. A review of the Dark Tower movie. The Dark Tower is not the movie that Stephen King, the Dark Tower epic, or Stephen King fans deserve. It is, at the same time, a reductionist spin-on and a purported continuation of King's story and characters that, unfortunately, diminishes the gravitas of the Dark Tower mythology. It's Jimmy Fallon and the Roots playing Call Me Maybe on toy instruments. It's recognizable as the song, but it's clearly a less-than rendering of what became a pop classic. The Dark Tower movie is also like saying you're making an omelet for four people, but only using one egg, and making up the difference with white rice. They say it's a sequel. Okay. But where in the movie is it established that it is a sequel to an existing story? And how would viewers who have never read a Dark Tower book know that this isn't from the Dark Tower novels? At the very beginning of the movie, "Based on the Dark Tower novels" appears on the screen. Say what? It is, thus, a failure as a sequel and a failure as an adaptation, and it's certainly not part of the Stephen King canon because it was not written by Cy King himself. Sure, the movie has characters we know. Some. But where's Susanna, Eddie, Oi, Blaine? And scenarios we don't. The Breakers are kids? Roland's motivation is revenge? But overall, it proves it's probably not a good idea to adapt or claim to write a sequel to a 7-volume series and condense it into 95 minutes. It sounds ludicrous to even verbalize the idea. The Dark Tower should have been given the Lord of the Rings multiple film treatment or the HBO Game of Thrones multiple episodes and multiple seasons treatment. So, with that all being said, I'll now say this. I did like it. It was fun. I enjoyed watching it. And I've come to the conclusion that the only way for Stephen King fans to watch the Dark Tower movie without stroking out is to forget that the books exist. Context is everything. So go into it with the idea that it's a freestanding fantasy thriller. Otherwise, it'll drive you nuts. In conclusion, here's the best exchange in the movie. Roland and Jake are at a food cart on a New York street in Keystone Earth. Roland: "What is this?" Jake: "A hot dog." Roland: "Savages." Takes a bite. "What breed?" Pet Sematary, 1983. When the Creeds move into a beautiful old house in rural Maine, it all seems too good to be true. Pet Sematary has been described by many readers and critics as the most frightening book Stephen King has written. Pet Sematary is the novel Stephen King felt was too horrific to publish. In fact, when he finished it in 1979, he put it in a drawer and refused to offer it for publication. As fulfillment of a contract with Doubleday, though, King eventually relented and allowed publication in 1983, but he refused to participate in the promotion of the book. In an interview with Douglas E. Winter in Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, King talked about the genesis of the idea for Pet Sematary. "When ideas come, they don't arrive with trumpets. They're quiet. There's no drama involved. I can remember crossing the road and thinking that the cat had been killed in the road, and I thought, what if a kid died in that road? And we had had this experience with Owen running toward the road, where I had just grabbed him and pulled him back, and the two things just came together. On one side of this two-lane highway was the idea of what if the cat came back, and on the other side of the highway was what if the kid came back. So that when I reached the other side, I had been galvanized by the idea, but not in any melodramatic way. I knew immediately that it was a novel." A film version of Pet Sematary came out in 1989 starring Dale Midkiff, Fred Gwynne, Denise Crosby, Brad Greenquist, Michael Lombard, and Miko Hughes. It was directed by Mary Lambert from a screenplay by Stephen King. Essential Stephen King ranking, 9. Christine, 1983. It's love at first sight for high school student Arnie Cunningham when he spots the dilapidated 1958 red and white Plymouth Fury for sale. A haunted car. In Has Success Spoiled Stephen King? Nah. By Pat Cadigan, Marty Ketchum, and Arnie Fenner in the winter 1982 issue of Sheol magazine, Stephen King said, "Christine is the first horror novel I've done, I think, since The Shining. That's all I'm going to say about it. Except it's scary. It's fun, too. It's maybe not my best book. It's kind of like a high school confidential. It's great from that angle." In an interview in the February 1984 issue of Twilight Zone magazine, Randy LaFissier asked King, "Why was Christine written using two different narrative styles?" King replied, "Because I got in a box. That's really the only reason. It almost killed the book. Dennis was supposed to tell the whole story, but then he got in a football accident and was in the hospital while things were going on that he couldn't see. For a long time, I tried to narrate the second part in terms of what he was hearing hearsay evidence, almost like depositions, but that didn't work. I tried to do it in a number of ways, and finally I said, let's cut through it. The only way to do this is to do it in the third person." In the novel, it is said that Christine the car was a four-door model. The first mention of this is in the chapter, First Views, when King writes, "He tried the back door on the passenger side, and it came open with a scream." However, Plymouth never made a four-door 1958 Plymouth Fury. They were all two-door. They changed the car to a two-door model for the John Carpenter movie version. Also, although all 1958 Plymouth Furies were manufactured in ivory color, in Christine, King states that Christine was custom-ordered in Ford Red. Essential Stephen King ranking, 39. The Talisman, 1984. Quote, "Why had 12-year-old Jack Sawyer's mother frantically moved the two of them from Rodeo Drive to a New York City apartment to the Alhambra?" End quote. The Talisman was co-written with Peter Straub. Stephen King's enormous popularity and worldwide fame was not allowed to overshadow the fact that The Talisman was a collaborative project and that its two authors each contributed to the book on an equal basis. The title page lists the two authors in alphabetical order. The copyright does likewise. The most blatant indication of the deliberate insistence that the two authors receive equal billing, though, is on the front and rear covers of the hardcover. The front of the book jacket has Stephen King on the top and Peter Straub on the bottom. The rear of the jacket has Peter Straub on the top and Stephen King on the bottom. In an interview with Douglas E. Winter in Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, King talked about collaborating on The Talisman with Peter Straub. "We both agreed that it would be nice to make the book seamless. It shouldn't seem like a game to readers to try to figure out who wrote what. When I worked on my half of the copy editing, I went through large chunks of the manuscript, unsure myself who had written what." In September 2017, Steven Spielberg, who has been working on an adaptation of The Talisman since 1984, issued a statement revealing that the project was still in development. He used the phrase, "our upcoming projects, The Talisman and The Wand." Essential Stephen King ranking, 12. Thinner, originally as Richard Bachman, 1984. Quote, attorney Billy Halleck seriously enjoys living his life of upper-class excess, end quote. Thinner was the book that revealed King's Richard Bachman pseudonym to the world. Thinner was originally published as a Richard Bachman book, but when the news broke that Bachman was King, NAL released all remaining and new copies of the book with a cardboard wrapper that said, Stephen King writing as Richard Bachman. The man who discovered in 1985 that Richard Bachman was a Stephen King alias was Stephen P. Brown, a freelance writer who also worked in a bookstore. After being convinced that the Richard Bachman novels he had read had actually been written by Stephen King, he did some research. He visited the Library of Congress and checked the copyright records for the four paperback Bachman novels, Rage, 1977, The Long Walk, 1979, Roadwork, 1981, and The Running Man, 1982. He discovered that three of the Bachman books had been copyrighted in the name of Kirby McCauley, who just so happened to be Stephen King's literary agent. That alone could have raised suspicions, but the beans, as they say, were spilled when Brown checked the copyright record for Rage. That book's copyright was in the name of Stephen King. Brown wrote King a letter. This was in the pre-email, snail mail days, explaining what he had discovered. In an April 9, 1985 article in the Washington Post, Stephen Brown told what happened next. One day, the phone rang. Steve Brown? This is Steve King. Okay, you know I'm Bachman. I know I'm Bachman. What are we going to do about it? Let's talk. In Thinner, Richard Ganelli, an Italian organized crime boss, owns a restaurant called The Three Brothers. In King's serial novel, The Plant, a character named Richard Ganelli owns a restaurant called The Forefathers. This is yet another clue that Thinner was written by Stephen King. But the only readers who would have noticed it were the lucky few who were receiving King's Plant Christmas mailings when Thinner was published. When King began offering the individual chapters of The Plant for sale on his website in 2000, King fans instantly noticed the Ganelli connection the day Chapter 3, the first time Ganelli is mentioned in The Plant, was posted on King's site. In an interview with Douglas E. Winter in Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, King said of the idea for Thinner, "After I started really losing weight, I couldn't help but feel attached to it. There's a line in the book about how our version of reality depends a lot on how we see our physical size. I began to think about just what would happen if someone who began to lose weight found he couldn't stop." Essential Stephen King ranking, 45. Cycle of the Werewolf, 1985. Quote, a werewolf is stalking Tarker's Mills, and only young, wheelchair-bound Marty Koslaw suspects the truth. End quote. King's werewolf novella. In the foreword to Silver Bullet, the volume containing the original Cycle of the Werewolf novella and King's Silver Bullet screenplay, King wrote, my wife Tabby reminded me that a year where all the full moons fell on holidays would be a mad year indeed. I agreed, but invoked creative license. I think your license should be revoked for speeding, dear, she said, and wandered off to make us all something to eat. The hero of Cycle of the Werewolf is Marty Koslaw, a 10-year-old boy who is paralyzed and confined to a wheelchair. King has often created heroic characters who are physically disabled in one way or another, from stuttering Bill Denbrough in It to Duddits in Dreamcatcher, who has Down syndrome. Cycle's Marty Koslaw is part of that fraternity, and he admirably ignores his handicap and, spoiler alert, triumphs over the werewolf. In Cycle of the Werewolf, Today Show weatherman Willard Scott tells his viewers that a foot of snow fell in the Canadian Rockies on September 21st, which is Stephen King's birthday. A film version of Cycle of the Werewolf was released in 1985 as Silver Bullet, a.k.a. Stephen King's Silver Bullet. It starred Gary Busey, Everett McGill, Corey Haim, Megan Follows, and Terry O'Quinn. It was directed by Daniel Attias from a screenplay by Stephen King. Essential Stephen King ranking, 61. It, 1986. Quote, welcome to Derry, Maine, a place as hauntingly familiar as your own hometown. Only in Derry, the haunting is real. End quote. Stephen King's magnum opus. Note, some consider the Dark Tower series King's magnum opus, and that is a valid judgment. I prefer to assign that accolade to a single volume, It. Stephen King's middle name is Edwin. And in It, there is a character named Eddie King, described as a bearded man whose spectacles were almost as fat as his gut. Eddie King was one of the guys playing poker in the sleepy Silver Dollar the day Claude Heroux went nuts and killed everyone in the game. Eddie King's demise was particularly grisly. When Claude began his rampage, Eddie tried to flee, but ended up falling out of his chair and landing flat on his back on the floor. Claude straddled King, who was screaming to Claude that he had just gotten married a month ago, and buried an axe in Eddie King's ample belly. Claude then wiggled the axe out and swung again, this time putting an end to Eddie's screaming and to Eddie. Claude Heroux wasn't done with him, however. He began to chop King up like kindling wood. In his essay, How It Happened, King said, sometime in the summer of 1981, I realized that I had to write about the troll under the bridge or leave him, it, forever. Part of me cried to let it go, but part of me cried for the chance, did more than cry. It demanded. I remember sitting on the porch, smoking, asking myself if I had really gotten old enough to be afraid to try, to just jump in and drive fast. I got up off the porch, went into my study, cranked up some rock and roll, and started to write the book. I knew it would be long, but I didn't know how long. I found myself remembering that part of The Hobbit where Bilbo Baggins marvels at how way may lead on to way. You may leave your front door and think you are only strolling down your front walk, but at the end of your walk is the street, and you may turn left or you may turn right, but either way, there will be another street, another avenue, and roads and highways and a whole world. Note, King was 34 when he started writing It. He was 38 when he finished it. The 2017 film adaptation, part one of a two-part series of It, scored the second biggest weekend opening for a horror film. It is currently number one for highest-grossing horror film of all time. On January 12, 2018, Deadline Hollywood announced that the film had reached a box office gross of $700.2 million worldwide. Essential Stephen King ranking? 1. The Eyes of the Dragon, 1987. Quote, "Once, in a kingdom called Delane, there was a king with two sons." End quote. Stephen King wrote The Eyes of the Dragon for his daughter Naomi. The Eyes of the Dragon is dedicated to Naomi King and also to King's great friend Peter Straub's son, Ben. On the dust jacket flap copy of the hardcover edition of The Eyes of the Dragon, King wrote, "I respected my daughter enough then and now to try and give her my best, and that includes a refusal to talk down. Or, put another way, I did her the courtesy of writing for myself as well as for her." In The Eyes of the Dragon, our friend Flag owns a paperweight made of obsidian, which, at the time, was the hardest rock known. This is revealing, since obsidian, which is really natural glass with a hardness of only 5, diamond, the hardest gem, is a 10, is formed only in areas of volcanic activity and is actually volcanic lava that cooled too quickly. This means that it is possible that, at some point, there had to have been volcanoes in or near Delane, or that Flag had traveled in areas with volcanic activity, and that opal, peridot, onyx, aquamarine, emerald, topaz, cat's eye, ruby, sapphire, and, of course, diamond, all of which have hardness ratings higher than 5, had not yet been discovered. An animated adaptation of The Eyes of the Dragon with a $45 million budget was scheduled for completion in early 2001 and release in late 2001 or early 2002. The project was abandoned after the rights lapsed in 2000. In 2012, the cable channel Sci-Fi announced they were developing several projects for potential television adaptations, one of which was The Eyes of the Dragon. Essential Stephen King ranking, 18. Misery, 1987. Quote, "Paul Sheldon is a best-selling novelist who has finally met his number one fan. Her name is Annie Wilkes." Misery is the novel that was inspired by certain experiences King had had with fans. Like any good fabulist, he extrapolated the persona of certain intense fans to create the one and only Annie Wilkes. The dedication of Misery reads, "To Jim and Stephanie Leonard, who know why. Boy, do they." At the time, Stephanie was the editor of Castle Rock, the Stephen King newsletter, and dealt with King's fan mail on a regular basis. Read into that what you will. In an October 31, 2014 interview with Rolling Stone, King said, "Misery is a book about cocaine. Annie Wilkes is cocaine. She was my number one fan." In a 1998 interview with journalist Peter Conrad, quoted in On Writing, King said, "I wrote most of Misery by hand, sitting at Kipling's desk in Brown's Hotel in London. Then I found out he died at the desk. That spooked me, so I quit the hotel." King originally planned on publishing Misery as a Richard Bachman novel. Essential Stephen King ranking, 7. This exchange is from a 1998 interview with journalist Ben Rewarted. Q. "And have you had any bad experiences with a number one fan yourself?" Stephen King. "I haven't directly, but my wife has. There was a guy who broke into our house when she was home alone. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning, and she had just got up when she heard glass breaking downstairs." Q. "And she went down to investigate?" Stephen King. "Yes." Q. "What did he look like?" Stephen King. "He looked like Charles Manson with long hair, and he had a rucksack in his hands. He said that he was my biggest fan. Then he stopped suddenly and said he actually hated me because I'd stolen the novel Misery from his aunt. Then he held up the rucksack and said that he had a bomb and was going to blow her up." Q. "Jesus, what did your wife do?" Stephen King. "She ran out in her bare feet and nightgown, man. The police came round and he was still there. It turned out that all he had in the bag was a load of pencils and paperclips in a box." Q. "What was up with him then?" Stephen King. "It turned out he was from Texas. His aunt was a nurse who'd been fired from some hospital, and he made a connection with the nurse in Misery." The Tommyknockers, 1987. Quote, "On a beautiful June day while walking deep in the woods, Bobby Anderson quite literally stumbles over her own destiny." End quote. one of King's blatant science fiction novels. Others include 112263, Time Travel, Dreamcatcher, Aliens, Firestarter, Pyrokinesis, Carrie, Telekinesis, and Under the Dome, Force Field. Note, genres overlap, especially when it comes to King's work, but when a sci-fi superpower or elements are dominant in a story, we call it science fiction. King's sci-fi short stories and novellas include The Jaunt, Word Processor of the Gods, Obits, I Am the Doorway, Beach World, The Mist, The Langoliers, The End of the Whole Mess, The Sundog, and others. In an October 31st, 2014 interview with Rolling Stone, King said, "The Tommyknockers is an awful book. That was the last one I wrote before I cleaned up my act, and I've thought about it a lot lately and said to myself, there's really a good book in here, underneath all the sort of spurious energy that cocaine provides, and I ought to go back." The book is about 700 pages long, and I'm thinking, there's probably a good 350-page novel in there. Essential Stephen King ranking, 72. The Dark Half, 1989. Quote, "After 13 years of international bestseller stardom with his works of violent crime fiction, author George Stark is officially declared dead." End quote. The Dark Half is seen by many as King writing about having a pseudonym, Richard Bachman, that was discovered, but, of course, with an added Stephen King element. The nightmarish premise of The Dark Half is the what-if question. What if a writer's pseudonym refused to stay dead? The Dark Half's character of Wilhelmina Burks, Raleigh DeLessop's girlfriend, may be an homage to an earlier King character named Wilma Northrup. Wilma Northrup first appeared in July 1979 in Gallery Magazine in Stephen King's short story The Crate. Wilma later appeared in King's 1982 film Creepshow, which included a King-scripted adaptation of The Crate. In both versions of the story, Wilma Northrup told people, "Just call me Billy. Everyone does." The first time Wilhelmina Burks is mentioned in The Dark Half, she is described as the one who goes around blaring, "Just call me Billy. Everyone does." In an interview in the November-December 1989 issue of Walden Books magazine WB, King commented on the genesis of The Dark Half. "I started to play with the idea of multiple personalities, and then I read somewhere, probably in the case of the twin doctors that the film Dead Ringers was based on, that sometimes twins are imperfectly absorbed in the womb, and I thought, now wait a minute, what if this guy is the ghost of a twin that never existed? After that, I was able to wrap the whole book around that spine, and it made everything a lot more coherent." In the notes to Nightmares and Dreamscapes, King wrote that The Dark Half was originally an almost completed novel called Machine's Way, written by Richard Bachman's pseudonym George Stark. The Dark Half has one of the great openings of a Stephen King novel. In the prologue, the young Thad Beaumont has brain surgery and an eye is found peering out of his gray matter, causing Nurse Hillary to flee screaming from the operating room. The operating surgeon, Dr. Pritchard, nonchalantly says, "I want that silly cunt that ran out of here fired. Make a note, please." A film version of The Dark Half was released in 1993 starring Timothy Hutton, Amy Madigan, Michael Rooker, and Julie Harris. It was directed by George A. Romero from Romero's own screenplay adaptation of the novel. Essential Stephen King ranking, 22. The Dark Half Phone Number Story by Gerald Winters. When Stephen King was writing The Dark Half in 1989, he came to the part of the story where Sheriff Alan Pangborn needed to speak with a Dr. Pritchard in Wyoming, the doctor that had treated a suspect of his when he was a child, Thad Beaumont. Alan left a message on his answering machine requesting that he call him back as soon as possible, as it was an urgent matter. The message included, "Please call me collect at the Orono State Police Barracks, 207-866-2121. Thank you." Stephen King knew he was writing about a police station in his nearby Orono, Maine, so why not get the real number, which is exactly what he did. It was there in the phone book in bold type. What happened after the book was published was anything other than expected. Constant readers from all over the world started to call the number, and why not? It was in Stephen King's book, plain as black and white. Could there be a coded message to surprise callers or a mystery person that was just curious if anyone would call? No, it was the Orono State Police, and specifically Dan Lawrence, the dispatcher. Dan fielded calls from Montana, Florida, California, and as far away as Japan, the UK, and Australia. Why not? It's only an international call to their favorite author's home state. Many callers told Dan they would be vacationing in Maine in the summer of 1990 and asked whether they could visit him for his autograph. Finding the humor in the situation, Dan located the passage in Mr. King's latest novel, and sure enough, he saw his number on page 210, chapter 16. Dan felt the need to write a letter to the editor at Bangor Daily News, but like Mr. King, he never realized the chain of events that would transpire from that simple act. He got a chance to visit his favorite author's office and receive an inscription in his personal copy. Mr. King apologized for his oversight, and true to his word, he changed the number in the later printing of the paperback. Gerald Winters is the proprietor of Gerald Winters & Son Booksellers in Bangor, Maine. The Stand, the complete and uncut edition, 1990. In May 1990, Doubleday released the uncut edition of The Stand, restoring approximately 150,000 words that were cut from the original 1978 edition. The New York Times, in its review of the uncut edition by Robert Kiley, a professor of English at Harvard, provided an all-time truly memorable line from a book review. "Hundreds of pages of text are devoted to vignettes, some poignant, nearly all disgusting, of Americans in all regions and walks of life being stopped in the tracks of their ordinary existence by the dread and incurable disease." It's the additional characters and scenes in the uncut edition that make it a much richer experience. Some examples. We learned that Flagg had communicated with Nadine Cross when she was in her teens. The scene where he talks to her via a Ouija board is terrifying. Also, the scene of Franny Goldsmith's confrontation with her mother over her pregnancy is incredibly powerful. King describes the living room as filled with segments of time in a dry age. My Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia has 6 2-column pages of additional characters in the uncut edition. In 1994, ABC aired Stephen King's The Stand as a miniseries, starring Gary Sinise, Molly Ringwald, Jamie Sheridan, Ruby Dee, Miguel Ferrer, and many others. It was directed by Mick Garris from a screenplay by Stephen King. The opening of the movie, in which Captain Trips escapes the lab, is set to Blue Oyster Cult's Don't Fear the Reaper, and is one of the greatest opening sequences of all time. Essential Stephen King ranking, 2. Needful Things, 1991. Quote, "The town of Castle Rock, Maine, has seen its fair share of oddities over the years, but nothing is as peculiar as the little curio shop that just opened for business." End quote. Needful Things was promoted as the last Castle Rock story. It turned out not to be. In an August 9, 1998 UK interview with Peter Conrad, King said, "Everything's for sale, and the only price is your immortal soul. I thought Needful Things was fucking hilarious." In the coda to Needful Things, Leland Gaunt opens a new store, Answered Prayers, in Junction City, Iowa, which is the home of Ardelia Lortz and the library policeman. Essential Stephen King ranking, 24. Gerald's Game, 1992. Quote, "Once again, Jessie Burlingame has been talked into submitting to her husband Gerald's kinky sex games." End quote. The first of King's 3 abused women-themed novels, Gerald's Game, Dolores Claiborne, and Rose Madder. In a 2006 interview with the Paris Review, King described the research process for Gerald's Game. Gerald's Game is about only one person, Jessie, who has been handcuffed naked to her bed. The little things all get so big, the glass of water and her trying to get the shelf above the bed to tip up so she can escape. Going into that book, I remember thinking that Jessie would have been some sort of gymnast at school, and at the end of it she would simply put her feet back over her head, over the bedstead, and wind up standing up. About 40 pages into writing it, I said to myself, I better see if this works. So I got my son, I think it was Joe because he's the more limber of the two boys, and I took him into our bedroom. I tied him with scarves to the bedposts. My wife came in and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm doing an experiment, never mind." Joe tried to do it, but he couldn't. He said, "My joints don't work that way." And the only thing you can do at that point is say, "Well, I could make her double-jointed." Then you go, "Yeah, right, that's not fair." A film adaptation of Gerald's Game was released on September 29, 2017 on Netflix. It starred Carla Gugino and Bruce Greenwood. It was directed by Mike Flanagan from a screenplay by Flanagan and Jeff Howard. After watching an early cut of the film, King tweeted the following. "Saw a rough cut of Mike Flanagan's Gerald's Game yesterday. Horrifying, hypnotic, terrific. It's going to freak you out." In a January 1st, 2018 interview with CinemaBlend, Flanagan said the next Stephen King novel he would like to adapt would be either Dr. Sleep or Lisi's Story. He said, "The ones I'd want to do the most are Dr. Sleep and Lisi's Story. In both cases, it's because I identify with the protagonist so much. Lisi's Story is a stunning piece of work, a beautiful exploration of marriage, and who wouldn't want to venture back into the world of Danny Torrance?" At the end of January 2018, Warner Brothers confirmed that Flanagan would indeed be directing the Dr. Sleep film. Flanagan said he'd rewrite the script that was originally written by Akiva Goldsman. Essential Stephen King ranking, 25. Dolores Claiborne, 1993. Quote, "When Vera Donovan dies suddenly in her home, suspicion is immediately cast on her housekeeper and caretaker, Dolores Claiborne." End quote. The second of King's 3 abused women-themed novels, Gerald's Game, Dolores Claiborne, and Rose Madder. Dolores Claiborne is told entirely in the first-person voice of Dolores Claiborne St. George. In a December 1992 interview with USA Today to promote Dolores Claiborne, King said, "Don't say that I'm stretching my range or that I've left horror behind. I'm just trying to find things I haven't done to stay alive creatively." Dolores Claiborne and Gerald's Game were written in tandem, so to speak, and were intended to be a 2-volume set called In the Path of the Eclipse. Here's how they are connected. As Dolores, on Little Tall Island, is waiting for Joe to die during the July 20th, 1963 eclipse, she experiences a psychic bond with young Jesse Burlingame of Gerald's Game, as Jesse's father is sexually molesting her. King does not fully explain the connection, but it obviously has something to do with the fact that Dolores' daughter Selena was similarly abused by her father Joe. A film version of Dolores Claiborne was released in 1995 and starred Kathy Bates and Jennifer Jason Leigh. It was directed by Taylor Hackford from a screenplay by Tony Gilroy. Essential Stephen King ranking, 15. Insomnia, 1994. Quote, Ralph Roberts never expected to live out his remaining golden years mourning the death of his beloved wife. End quote. Insomnia is a Dark Tower novel in the sense that the novel was given to Roland by Moses Carver in the Dark Tower, but Roland threw it away. Insomnia is dedicated to King's wife Tabby, and also to musician Al Cooper. Cooper was one of the professional ringers who toured with King's band the Rock Bottom Remainders and who participated in their band-written book, Midlife Confidential. The original hardcover edition was published with two different covers. One had Insomnia in red and Stephen King in white, and the other had the colors reversed. In 1994, Insomnia was nominated for a Bram Stoker Award for Best Novel, but Dead in the Water by Nancy Holder won that year. Essential Stephen King ranking, 11. The Regulators, initially as Richard Bachman, 1995. Quote, It's a gorgeous midsummer afternoon along Poplar Street in the peaceful suburbia of Wentworth, Ohio. End quote. King said the epiphany as to how to write The Regulators came one day while backing out of his driveway. The idea was to take characters from Desperation and put them into The Regulators. In some cases, I thought they could play the same people, in others they would change. In neither would they do the same things or react in the same ways, because the different stories would dictate different courses of action. It would be, I thought, like the members of a repertory company acting in two different ways. Essential Stephen King ranking, 52. Rose Madder, 1995. After surviving 14 years of hell in a violently abusive marriage, Rosie Daniels finally summons the courage to flee for her life. The third of King's three abused women-themed novels, Gerald's Game, Dolores Claiborne, and Rose Madder. In Rose Madder, King introduces us to the character of Norman Daniels, an abusive cop who thinks nothing of beating and torturing not only his criminal suspects, but also his meekly subservient wife, Rosie. In the Stephen King universe, King authorities Stanley Weotter, Christopher Golden, and Hank Wagner state with certainty that Rose Madder stands as King's most unflinching look at abuse. The character of Wendy Yarrow, who is reincarnated into the world of Rosie's painting as Dorcas, and who acts as a mentor to Rosie, may be an homage to King's wife Tabitha. Check out the biblical verse Acts 9:36, KJV. Now there was at Joppa a certain disciple named Tabitha, which by interpretation is called Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and alms deeds, which she did. Rose Madder got a starred review, the highest, in the May 1995 issue of Publishers Weekly, in which they said, relentlessly paced and brilliantly orchestrated, this cat-and-mouse game of a novel is one of King's most engrossing and topical horror stories. At the center of the action is heroine Rose McClendon, a battered wife who starts life anew by leaving her police officer husband, a consummately cruel man depicted by King as a paragon of evil. Crowded with character and incident, the novel builds to a nearly apocalyptic conclusion that combines the best of King's long novels, the breadth and vision of The Stand, for example, with the focused plot and careful psychological portraiture of Dolores Claiborne. The story of Rose's joyous growth from tortured wife, her persecution gruesomely but realistically portrayed, to independent woman, alternates with the terrifying details of her husband's deliberate pursuit to create unflagging tension. The book is a phantasmagorical rollercoaster ride, peopled by a broad array of indelibly characterized men and women and fueled by an air of danger that is immediate and overwhelming. IMDb.com reports that a film version of the novel is in development. Essential Stephen King ranking, 17. Desperation, 1996. Quote, Police officer Collie Intrigian, chief law enforcement for the small mining town of Desperation, Nevada, appears to be completely insane. End quote. Desperation is what has come to be known as Classic King, or Classic King with two Ks, as some way too clever journalist might suggest. The Stephen King of The Stand and The Shining and Salem's Lot and even It. It is a sprawling tale of a band of pilgrims who come face to face with a minion of a possibly eternal evil and who must depend on the wisdom and God-centeredness of a young boy who just may have a direct line to the big guy himself. Considering the spiritual slash metaphysical bent to some of King's more thoughtful works, including The Green Mile, Desperation, and The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, his comments on religion in his March 5, 1999 letter to reviewers that was included with review copies of The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon are especially interesting. I've been writing about God, the possibility of God, and the consequences for humans if God does exist, for 20 years now, ever since the stand. I have no interest in preaching or in organized religion, and no patience with zealots who claim to have the one true pipeline to the big guy. In a November 17, 1988 interview with Janet Bewley, King talked about his perception of good and evil. Above all else, I'm interested in good and evil, and I'm interested in the question about whether or not there are powers of good and powers of evil that exist outside ourselves. I think that the concept of evil is something that's in the human heart. The goodness in the human heart is probably more interesting psychologically, but in terms of myth, the idea that there are forces of evil and forces of good outside, and because I was raised in a fairly strict religious home, not hard-shelled Baptist or anything like that, I tend to coalesce those concepts around God symbols and devil symbols, and I put them in my work. Essential Stephen King Ranking, 13. The Green Mile. Quote, "Welcome to Cold Mountain Penitentiary, home to the depression-worn men of E-Block," end quote. Part 1, The Two Dead Girls, March 1996. Part 2, The Mouse on the Mile, April 1996. Part 3, Coffee's Hands, May 1996. Part 4, The Bad Death of Edward Delacroix, June 1996. Part 5, Night Journey, July 1996. Part 6, Coffee on the Mile, August 1996. In the introduction to the single-volume edition of The Green Mile, King talked about the writing of the serial novel. "I wrote like a madman, trying to keep up with the crazy publishing schedule and at the same time trying to craft the book so that each part would have its own mini-climax, hoping that everything would fit and knowing I'd be hung if it didn't." At one point, there was a rumor going around that Tom Hanks was slated to play the John Coffey role in the film. Tyson Blue explains this in an excerpt from his book, The Making of The Green Mile. While rumors on the internet and other sources had at least some rational basis, one went so far as to suggest that Hanks had even wanted to play John Coffey, the rationale being that he enjoyed taking roles which gave him a chance to expand the horizons of his acting. Hanks could easily understand how these rumors could begin. "That's the other thing that's remarkably miraculous about this story is that they're all good roles," he said. "It's that kind of ensemble piece, you know? The only thing that makes me number one on the call sheet is that Paul's the narrator. Other than that, all the guys have great parts. I certainly would have jumped at the chance to play, say, Wild Bill or even Percy, although I'm not short enough to be Percy. It's such a key thing." Essential Stephen King Ranking, 5. Bag of Bones, September 1998. Quote, "4 years after the sudden death of his wife, best-selling novelist Mike Noonan is still grieving," end quote. Bag of Bones was the novel that marked King's departure from Viking for his new publishing home, Scribner. Bag of Bones was inspired by and is an homage to Daphne du Maurier's novel, Rebecca. King said, "Bag of Bones contains everything I know about marriage, lust, and ghosts." Bag of Bones was Stephen King's first authentic ghost story since Pet Sematary. It revisits Castle Rock in Derry, the setting of It, Insomnia, and Dreamcatcher, and centers on a best-selling writer's grief over his wife's death, a tragedy which is somehow related to some strange doings at their summer lakeside place, known as Sarah Laughs in western Maine. Bag of Bones boasts an ancient curse, dazzling sequences of mind-boggling and horrifying paranormal activity, as well as a couple of the most memorable villains with which King has ever blessed us. In King's May 1998 letter to reviewers of Hearts in Atlantis, included with review copies of the book, King wrote about Bag of Bones. "I hope Bag of Bones gives you at least one sleepless night. Sorry about that. It's just the way I am. It gave me one or two, and ever since writing it, I'm nervous about going down into the cellar. Part of me keeps expecting the door to slam, the light to go out, and the knocking to start. But for me, at least, that's also part of the fun. If that makes me sick, hey, don't call the doctor." In the Stephen King universe, the authors write, "Simply stated, Bag of Bones ranks amongst the 4 or 5 best novels the author has written in his entire career." The title of the novel comes from something British author Thomas Hardy, a King favorite, reportedly once said, "Compared to the dullest human being actually walking about on the face of the earth and casting his shadow there, the most brilliantly drawn character in the novel is but a bag of bones." King's final reference to Hardy's remark, of several in the novel, occurs in the book's second-to-last paragraph when he writes, "Thomas Hardy, who supposedly said that the most brilliantly drawn character in the novel is but a bag of bones, stopped writing novels himself after finishing Jude the Obscure, and while he was at the height of his narrative genius." Essential Stephen King Ranking, 6. The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, 1999. Quote, "During a 6-mile hike on the Maine, New Hampshire branch of the Appalachian Trail, 9-year-old Tricia McFarland wanders off by herself," end quote. The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon may have been inspired by William Blake's 2 connected poems, The Little Girl Lost and The Little Girl Found. King has also said that for this novel, he wanted to write Hansel and Gretel without Hansel. In The Little Girl Lost, the young girl, the Tricia McFarland character in Tom Gordon, is named Laika. She is 7 years old and ends up lost in a desert wild. Like Trish, Laika wandered long, slept under a tree, while the beasts of prey, come from caverns deep, viewed the maid asleep. Also, there is a scene in the poem where Laika watches the moon rise, echoing a similar scene in Tom Gordon. Blake's companion poem to Little Girl Lost is The Little Girl Found. It contains a scene in which Laika is found and carried in the arms of her rescuer. In his arms he bore her, armed with sorrow sore. This scene is similar to the scene in The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, in which Travis Herrick carries Trisha out of the woods. She wanted to tell him she was glad to be carried, glad to be rescued. In the author's postscript to this novel, King tells us that even though Tom Gordon, the baseball player, is real, the Tom Gordon in the novel is fictional. King then makes a revealing comment about the nature of fame and his own celebrity. The impression fans have of people who have achieved some degree of celebrity are always fictional, as I can attest to my own personal experience. In a March 5, 1999 letter to reviewers, King wrote, "My heroine Trisha would be a child of divorce living with her mother and maintaining a meaningful connection with her father mostly through their mutual love of baseball and the Boston Red Sox. Lost in the woods, she'd find herself imagining that her favorite Red Sox player was with her, keeping her company and guiding her through the terrible situation in which she found herself. Tom Gordon, number 36, would be that player. Gordon is a real pitcher for the Red Sox. Without his consent, I wouldn't have wanted to publish the book. He did give it, for which I am deeply grateful. The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon isn't about Tom Gordon or baseball, and not really about love, either. It's about survival and God, and it's about God's opposite as well. Because Trisha isn't alone in her wanderings. There is something else in the woods. The God of the Lost is how she comes to think of it. And in time, she'll have to face it." Director George A. Romero was attached to write and direct a film adaptation of The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon as early as 2001, but the project stalled in 2005. Romero died in 2017. In 2004, the Little Simon imprint of Simon & Schuster published a pop-up edition of The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. It was 14 pages with elaborate pop-up depictions of scenes from throughout the story. Essential Stephen King ranking, 32. Dreamcatcher, 2001. Quote, 25 years ago, in their haunted hometown of Derry, Maine, four boys bravely stood together. End quote. King originally titled this novel Cancer, but changed it on the urging of his wife, novelist Tabitha King, who refused to refer to it by that title. In a live AOL chat on September 19, 2000, King said, "Dreamcatcher has got a little bit of that Stand vibe. My accident changed everything. Not all those changes are bad, but it's a little easier to see the small shit in life for what it is after you've almost gotten the gate." One interesting point that can be discussed without giving anything away is that, in Dreamcatcher, a victim of an automobile accident reveals that he learned after his recovery that he had died in the ambulance and needed to be shocked with cardiac paddles to resuscitate his heartbeat. This begs the question, is this fictional incident a way for Stephen King to reveal something none of his fans knew? A film version of Dreamcatcher was released in 2003. It starred Morgan Freeman, Thomas Jane, Jason Lee, Damian Lewis, Timothy Oliphant, Tom Sizemore, and Donnie Wahlberg. It was directed by Lawrence Kasdan from a screenplay by William Goldman and Kasdan. Essential Stephen King ranking, 26. Black House, 2001. Quote, 20 years ago, a boy named Jack Sawyer traveled to a parallel universe called the Territories to save his mother and her Territories twinner from an agonizing death. End quote. Black House was written by Stephen King and Peter Straub and is a sequel to The Talisman. Black House was nominated for a 2001 Bram Stoker Award. It lost to Neil Gaiman's American Gods. The cannibalistic serial killer known as The Fisherman in Black House is based on real-world serial killer Albert Fish. The Fisherman is aware of the real Fish and intentionally emulates his style, so to speak. There are crossover elements in Black House that connect it to the Dark Tower series, including The Crimson King, Apopanax, and Twinners. From a Publisher's Weekly review of Black House, "The book abounds with literary allusions, many to the King verse, and readers not familiar with King's work, and particularly with The Talisman, may feel disoriented, especially at first. But there's so much here to revel in. From expertly executed sequences of terror, awe, or passion, the novel is a deep reservoir of genuine emotion, to some of the most wonderful characters to spring from a page in years, to a story whose energy is so high and craft so accomplished that most readers will wish it ran twice its great length. What is probably the most anticipated novel of the year turns out to be a high point in both the King and Straub canons." Black House is reportedly the second book of the Jack Sawyer trilogy, and King has acknowledged his and Straub's plans to write the third. Regarding the third book, King said the following in an interview with Lelia's Library. "Jack is hurt, goes over to the Territories, and the way things are left is that he'll be okay if he's over there on the other side, but if he comes back to our world, he will sicken and die in short order. So, of course, you have to put him in some sort of situation where he has to come back, and then the clock is ticking." From a Buick 8, 2002. Quote, "Since 1979, the state police of Troop D in rural Pennsylvania have kept a secret in the shed out behind the barracks. End quote. From a Buick 8's title came from a Bob Dylan song called From a Buick 6. Is the Buick 8 related to Christine? Not likely, since Christine was most assuredly born and raised in the U.S. of A., and the Buick 8 was definitely not. From a Buick 8 is a horror novel, but one with a strong science fiction element. The Buick 8 is not a car, and it could very well be a portal to another, what, planet? Dimension? It's actually, spoiler alert, a fake car. Nothing in it is real, and it can heal itself. Can it be destroyed? Should it be destroyed? It has killed, after all. Toby Hooper was attached to direct a film adaptation of the novel, but financing stalled the project. Hooper died in 2017. The Colorado Kid, 2005. Quote, Vince Teague and Dave Bowie are the sole operators of the Weekly Islander, a small Maine newspaper. When intern Stephanie asks if they've ever come across a real unexplained mystery, they tell her the story of the Colorado Kid. End quote. Gotta love a story that boasts an editor named David Bowie. Two old-school newspaper guys and a young intern worked to solve a mystery of the Colorado Kid, a Colorado man whose body was found in 1980 on the Maine island of Moose Lookit. A TV series, somewhat based on the novel, premiered on the Sci-Fi Channel in 2009 called Haven. It ran for 5 seasons. Cell, 2006. Quote, Clayton Riddle just landed a deal that might finally enable him to make art instead of teaching it. But all those good feelings about the future change in a hurry, due to The Pulse. End quote. A science fiction novel about evil cell phones. The Pulse, a signal transmitted to every cell phone in the world, turns users into ravenous killer zombies. A film adaptation of Cell was released in 2016 starring John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson. It was directed by Todd Williams from a screenplay by Stephen King. Spoiler from Stephen King via Lelia's Library. Based on the information given in the final third of Cell, I'm thinking about the reversion back toward the norm of the later phone crazies. It seems pretty obvious to me that things turned out well for Clay's son Johnny. I don't need to tell you this, do I? Lisi's Story, 2006. Quote, Lisi lost her husband Scott after a 25-year marriage of profound and sometimes frightening intimacy. End quote. In a 2007 interview with Lelia's Library, King stated that he considered Lisi's story his best book. In an October 31, 2014 interview with Rolling Stone, King was asked, if you had to pick your best book, what would it be? His response? Lisi's Story. That one felt like an important book to me because it was about marriage, and I'd never written about that. I wanted to talk about two things. One is the secret world that people build inside a marriage, and the other was that even in the intimate world, there's still things that we don't know about each other. Blaze, as Richard Bachman, 2007. Quote, Blaze is the story of Clayton Blaisdell Jr., of the crimes committed against him, and the crimes he commits. End quote. In an interview with Lelia's Library, King talked about Blaze. I've been thinking about Blaze off and on for a while, and every time I would think about it, you know, I did the early books as Richard Bachman books, and this is going to be a Bachman because it came from the same time. It was written right before Carrie, and finally I thought to myself, the reason I've never done it was because, in my memory at least, it was a tearjerker of a book. You know, it was kind of sentimental and just kind of, every now and then I think of what Oscar Wilde said about The Little Match Girl. He said that it's impossible to read about The Little Match Girl without weeping tears of laughter and, you know, something that is so sad it's actually funny. Blaze tells the story of an abused, mentally challenged, 300-pound man, Clayton Blaisdell Jr., who kidnaps an infant and holds him hostage. Blaze is King's homage to John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, a novella he has referred to several times in his writings. King describes Blaze as a literary imitation. The character of Clayton, a.k.a. Blaze, is similar to Lenny in the Steinbeck novella. King said of the original manuscript that some of the pages of Blaze have been typed on the reverse side of milk bills. As Kevin Quigley puts it in a review of Blaze on his Charnel House website, this being a Bachman book, a happy ending isn't really in the offing, and a happy ending is not what the reader gets. Duma Key, 2008. Quote, a terrible construction site accident takes Edgar Freemantle's right arm and scrambles his memory and his mind. End quote. Stephen King's first Florida novel. Edgar Freemantle is a loser, specifically of his wife and his right arm. Racked with depression and suicidal thoughts, he rents a beach house on Duma Key, a small island off the coast of Florida. It is there that he begins to paint, and it is then Edgar learns that, like Michael Anderson and his obituaries in the short story Obits, his paintings have powers. What he paints happens. And then an evil entity known as Perse, really the Greek goddess Persephone, manifests to seek revenge on the Alzheimer's-afflicted co-owner of Duma Key, Elizabeth Eastlake. Then chaos ensues, which may or may not result in the total destruction of Duma Key. A film version of Duma Key is in development. Under the Dome, 2009. Quote, on a beautiful fall day, the small town of Chester's Mill, Maine, is suddenly and inexplicably sealed off from the rest of the world by an invisible force field. End quote. In an April 1, 2017 essay for the UK Guardian titled Stephen King on Donald Trump, How Do Such Men Rise? First as a Joke, King compared Under the Dome's Jim Rennie to Donald Trump. Big Jim Rennie in Under the Dome is cut from the same cloth. He's a car salesman, selling being a key requirement for the successful politician, who is the head selectman in the small town of Chester's Mill, when a dome comes down and cuts the community off from the world. He's a crook, a cousiner, and a sociopath, the worst possible choice in a time of crisis. But he's got a folksy, straight-from-the-shoulder delivery that people relate to. The fact that he's incompetent at best and downright malevolent at worst doesn't matter. The Under the Dome TV series ran on CBS from June 24, 2013 through September 10, 2015. The series was developed by Brian K. Vaughan. It starred Mike Vogel, Rochelle Lefebvre, Alexander Koch, Marge Helgenberger, she was also in the Tommyknockers film, and Dean Norris, he was also in The Lawnmower Man, the one King sued over. In the Under the Dome episode Awakening, the character Big Jim lays his hand on a Bible on the top shelf of his locker. Next to the Bible is a black pork pie hat like the one Walter White wore in Breaking Bad. Dean Norris played Hank Schrader in Breaking Bad. 11-22-63, 2011. Jake Epping is a 35-year-old high school English teacher in Lisbon Falls, Maine, who makes extra money teaching adults in the GED program. End quote. 11-22-63 is Stephen King's alternate history novel about the JFK assassination. What would have happened if someone had been able to go back in time and kill Lee Harvey Oswald before he killed John F. Kennedy? We find out in this novel, and it's nowhere near what one might expect. In an interview promoting 11-22-63, King talked about the research he did to write the book. He said he read a stack of books as tall as he was, I'm paraphrasing, to fully understand the assassination and time period of 11-22-63. Dr. Sleep, 2013. Quote, on highways across America, a tribe of people called the True Knot travel in search of sustenance. End quote. Dr. Sleep is the sequel to King's 1977 novel, The Shining. Danny Torrance and Dick Halloran are still feeling the after effects of their experiences at the Overlook. Danny works in a hospice, is an alcoholic, like Papa Jack, has a psychic cat, and the two can sense when people are going to die. The True Knot consume steam. Steam is a psychic effluence that is produced when people feel pain. This premise sets up a truly nasty premise. A film version of the novel is currently in development with Akiva Goldsman, a beautiful mind, writing the script. Joyland, 2013. Quote, set in a small-town North Carolina amusement park in 1973, Joyland tells the story of the summer in which college student Devin Jones comes to work as a carny and confronts the legacy of a vicious murder. End quote. Tonally, and this is only one reader's opinion, Joyland feels a bit like Dr. Sleep. A film version of Joyland to be written and directed by Tate Taylor, Winter's Bone, is currently in development hell. Mr. Mercedes, 2014. A tweet from Stephen King. Donald Trump blocked me on Twitter. I am hereby blocking him from seeing it or Mr. Mercedes. No clowns for you, Donald. Go float yourself. Quote, in a high-suspense race against time, three of the most unlikely heroes Stephen King has ever created try to stop a lone killer from blowing up thousands. End quote. The first book in the Bill Hodges trilogy. A TV series adaptation of Mr. Mercedes debuted on the Audience Channel in August 2017. It was renewed for a second season to debut in 2018. Revival, 2014. Quote, the new minister came to Harlow, Maine, when Jamie Morton was a boy doing battle with his toy army men on the front lawn. End quote. Revival is Stephen King's Lovecraftian novel, i.e., a novel containing elements written in the style of H.P. Lovecraft. The final third of this novel is some of the scariest stuff King has ever written. Finders Keepers, 2015. Quote, wake up, genius! So announces deranged fan Morris Bellamy to iconic author John Rothstein. End quote. The second book in the Bill Hodges trilogy. Finders Keepers is about the murder of a famous writer named John Rothstein. End of Watch, 2016. Quote, for nearly 6 years, in room 217 of the Lakes Region Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic, Brady Hartsfield has been in a persistent vegetative state. End quote. End of Watch is the third book in the Bill Hodges trilogy. Is Detective Hodges doomed? Pancreatic cancer is often merciless. After his diagnosis, he works to solve a murder case he never closed. Before it's too late? Charlie the Choo-Choo, as Beryl Evans, 2016. Quote, engineer Bob has a secret. His train engine, Charlie the Choo-Choo, is alive, and also his best friend. End quote. King's publisher announced that this book is for ages 5 and up and grades preschool and up. Beryl Evans showed up at the 2016 Comic-Con to sign copies of Charlie. No one seemed to care that she had written the book in 1942 and was killed many years ago in another dimension. Evans, of course, is a pseudonym King used to write Charlie the Choo-Choo. Actress Allison Davies played Beryl at the convention. Sleeping Beauties 2017. Quote, "What might happen if women disappeared from the world of men?" End quote. Sleeping Beauties was co-written by Stephen King and his son Owen King, author of the 2005 collection We're All in This Together, the 2008 collection Who Can Save Us Now, Brand New Superheroes and Their Amazing Short Stories, the 2013 novel Double Feature, the 2015 comic Intro to Alien Invasion, co-written with Mark Jude Poiret, and the screenplay Fade Away, co-written with his brother Joe Hill, which is being developed as a TV series. In a September 25, 2017 co-interview with Owen for Entertainment Weekly, King said, "To be asked by Owen to collaborate on a book was the greatest thing in the world. You see these signs that say Smith & Sons Hardware stuff, so sons do follow in their father's footsteps, but in a specialized area of one of the arts, it was very gratifying to me." As research for the book, King and Owen visited a woman's prison in New Hampshire. Speaking of the visit, King told Entertainment Weekly that, "Any of those fantasy movies where you have a prison filled with these gorgeous women with great hair, we found out that wasn't the case. A lot of the women there just seem to be working through their time and not very happy about it, but doing what they have to do. We tried to put that in the book and make that prison as realistic as possible. I'm sure that a lot of people who staff women's prisons will say we got this wrong and we got that wrong, but I'm hoping that we got the flavor right." A tweet from Stephen King. "I and both of my sons are together on the New York Times bestseller list, Sleeping Beauties at number 4 and Joe's Strange Weather at number 9. Awesome." In the same interview, Owen also commented on the visit to the prison. "We wanted to respect people's experiences. It's something that we cared a lot about getting right as much as we possibly could. And, of course, fiction takes its own path, but we tried to stay true, even though the book is a fable." In April 2017, the entertainment company Anonymous Content purchased the TV rights to the novel. In November 2017, BuzzFeed asked famous writers which book they were most grateful for that year. This was Stephen King's response. "The book I'm most grateful for this year is Sleeping Beauties. I ordinarily wouldn't say that about a book I had a part in creating, but a man doesn't get a chance to collaborate with one of his children very often, or to find himself hardly able to keep up with that grown child's brilliant work. We also had a chance to go on tour together, and since we both have our own families and concerns, that was a rare opportunity." FYI, James Patterson was grateful for J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series. Joyce Carol Oates was grateful for James Joyce's Ulysses. R.L. Stine was grateful for Carl Hiaasen's Razor Girl. Chuck Palahniuk was grateful for Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son. And T.C. Boyle was grateful for Essays After 80 by Donald Hall, one of my all-time favorite books. In December 2017, Owen King wrote a note that was sent out to everyone on the Simon & Schuster mailing list, which read, "Dear reader, I've been enormously gratified by the response to Sleeping Beauties, the novel that I wrote with my father, Stephen King. Wow! A little surprised by some of the reactions, too. Who knew that so many people were so queasy about moths? They're just crackly, papery, little fluttering insects who are hardly ever a threat to anyone except on those rare occasions when a vengeful fairy commands them to attack. Pull yourselves together. For us, the experience of writing this novel was a delight. We love moths. We love vengeful fairies. We love getting together to spin out a story for all of you wonderful readers. Sleep is overrated. Let's stay up all night and flip some pages, shall we? Happy holidays, Owen King." An interview with Owen King and Stephen King about Sleeping Beauties. Owen King. "The idea for Sleeping Beauties was pretty random. In our family, we do a lot of pitching of ideas to each other. I had the idea and I said, well, what about a story about the world where all the women have fallen asleep? And my dad said, that's an awesome idea. And I said, great, go write it. Stephen King laughs and he said, no, you have to write it. But eventually we settled on writing it together. Stephen King. To me, when Owen pitched that idea, I don't know if we were on the phone or we were texting back and forth, but he said, what about if all the women fell asleep? And I immediately started to think of all the ramifications that were possible. And I said, you know, we really ought to write this. Then Owen said to me, what if we did it as a limited TV show? A TV series like 9 or 10 episodes. So we started to do a screenplay. We actually did a pilot. Owen King. And we did a second episode as well. Stephen King. Owen just kind of said, whoa, wait. We got to do this as a book. To Owen, right? Owen King. It was an exciting TV series. I felt hemmed in terms of the characterizations and the one-hour pacing. I wanted to do more with the characters, and I felt like it should be a book before it was a show. Stephen King. Yeah, when we read the book, it's hard for us to remember who wrote what. Owen rewrote me, and I rewrote Owen, and the thing is, when we finished this process, we were still friends. Owen King. Yeah. Stephen King. We still got along. We were still taking each other's calls, which is a great thing, but it's wonderful to be asked to collaborate with your son. What I didn't know was how good it was going to be and what the, you know, kind of the unique blending of your sensibility and mine. Owen King. Right, that sort of third voice. But that's why we rewrote each other, because we ended up with this third voice that's both of us. Stephen King. Yeah. The Outsider, May 2018. Quote, an unspeakable crime, a confounding investigation. End quote. King first revealed the title of this novel in an August 9th, 2017 interview with USA Today. At the Naperville, Illinois Sleeping Beauties book signing with Owen King on October 1st, 2017, an attendee reported to Hans Lilia of Lilia's Library that King said The Outsider was about a Southwest gentleman committing some murders and that there would be a character readers would recognize. Stephen Spignesi on The Outsider. One of my favorite TV series is HBO's The Night Of. It's an 8-episode series that was supposed to star James Gandolfini, but he had only shot the first episode at the time of his death. Gandolfini's role was taken over by John Turturro, and his performance garnered him nominations for an Emmy, a Golden Globe, and a SAG Award. The series itself won an American Film Institute Award for Best Television Series, and again, was nominated for an Emmy and a Golden Globe for Best Series. The Night Of was written by Richard Price, and I tell you all this to introduce this brief look at Stephen King's novel, The Outsider. Richard Price, whose credits also include Clockers, Sea of Love, The Deuce, and The Wanderers, has signed on to write a 10-episode adaptation of The Outsider, and, to me, it's as if King wrote another prison story and Frank Darabont signed on to adapt and direct it. The writing of The Night Of is extraordinary, and thus, I suspect Price's adaptation of The Outsider may very well end up in the upper echelon of King adaptations. But enough about the series. The novel is our topic for today. I think it will be difficult to write a comprehensive review without descending into the realm of spoilers, but we'll give it our best shot. What is The Outsider? It's a murder mystery, a police procedural and supernatural extravaganza, and a compelling human drama. And it is categorically superb. It has a revival-slash-dark half feel to it at times, and it brings back one of King's most appealing female characters, the damaged PI, Holly Gibney. The plot is sublime. A beloved Little League coach is arrested for killing an 11-year-old boy. They have more evidence against him than Carter has liver pills. But videotape emerges of him somewhere else at the time of the murder. Videotape that is incontrovertible. Not to mention the dozens of eyewitnesses who saw him in the aforementioned somewhere else. But someone can't be in two places at the same time, can they? Here's where we can imagine Cy King rubbing his hands together at his computer, laughing conspiratorially and whispering, "We'll just see about that." The novel can be described as having three acts, but not really. It's actually broken into several titled sections, and the whole story takes place over a few days in July. There are, however, three distinct story beats: the aftermath of the murder, the pursuit of the evidence, and the resolution in which the outsider of the title is revealed. It's very cinematic and very fast-paced. Any more would give stuff away, so let me conclude by saying The Outsider is a terrific novel, one of King's best, and I'm confident it will make an amazing TV series. And regarding possible awards for the forthcoming series, it will not surprise me if a cave wins for Best Supporting Actor at some point. If dogs could fly, nobody would go out without an umbrella. Stephen King, September 4th, 2017 tweet.